The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
Welcome, Ajahn.
Thank you
for being here away from California. Ajahn resides at Abhaya Giri Monastery in California, and he is gracious enough to come and visit us sometimes once a year, sometimes more.
Yeah.
So we're very grateful to have you back again this year. He's leading, giving this talk tonight, and then also doing a workshop tomorrow. And there's still space if anybody's interested in that. Metta as concentration practice is the title of that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So when I was originally talking to Mark about coming on this trip to Minnesota, I usually do come about once a year because my parents live compared to California, they live in Indiana, so it's the same neighborhood. So I always swing through Minnesota on the way to Indiana, and so I've had the great pleasure. It's been about 8 years since I've been coming, and. There's a few years where I didn't come when I was living in New Zealand with Ajahn Chandako, but almost all the other time I've tried to come at least once a year. And so it's we were still meeting in Mark and Wynn's living room when I first came, so it's quite lovely just to see how the Sangha here has grown and get to know people. And so I'm just glad to be back, very honored. When Mark initially asked, for a title, I don't know if it was Shelley who asked for a title, it was like 5 months ago, and I was just like, oh, come on, you get a title for talking to you 5 months from now. And I looked at the calendar, and I realized that we kind of knew that this would be the day, just because of the restrictions of my travels and things. And I don't know if anybody here knows, but today is actually, like, in Thailand, in most of Southeast Asia, today is like the most auspicious day in all of the entire year. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of like Christmas, Easter, 4th of July, all sort of rolled into one in terms of religious holidays in Thailand. And I was talking to my abbot, Ajahn Pasno, about this, and he said, it's interesting that in Thailand, sort of most of the Buddhist holidays, it's kind of an opportunity for a party. It's like get together with all your friends. You might come to the monastery for a little bit of some ceremonies and some rituals, but it's like kind of a stereotype of kind of Thai people is that they like to have a good time. So it's anytime they have a get together and cook and have a big meal and like that. It's any opportunity, and so the Buddhist holidays tend to be that. But Vesaka Puja, which is what today is called, it's Vesaka, the month of Vesaka. Full moon, the full moon of May, is it's still in Thailand. It's very held very reverentially. It's like people will come to the monastery and usually stay there all night long. I won't keep you up that long tonight, but we will at our monastery in California tonight. There'll be an all night vigil. We'll stay up, and I'll talk about some of the sort of ritual aspects of it and why we do it and why it's important, but how it can be an aid to our meditation practice. So it's not just something that we do just because it's on the calendar, but there can be actually real reasons that support our practice for doing it. And I think kind of in the West, most of us have come to the meditation practice as a form of, as a practice or a sort of a technique to be calm, to settle ourselves, and there's very good reasons for doing all of that. But there's many different aspects of say, Buddhism in general that we kind of miss out on in the West. It's something that we don't really even know about. Like, my parents are not Buddhist or anything like that, but I've been a monk for 14 years now and I've kind of lived in the monastery for 16. And it's just like I don't think they have even a clue that there's even such a thing as Buddhist holidays. And it's kind of a little bit of sadness in me, you know, that there's not that sort of recognition of, not necessarily for my parents, but just to sort of in sort of the Buddhist culture in general, too. There's just not much of a sense that there's anything other than sort of meditation practice. And living in a monastery, it was kind of interesting. Like, I think one of the reasons I was attracted to the particular monastery that I have ordained into, which is the Abhayagiri Buddhist Monastery in Northern California, was I was visiting various monasteries. I started my kind of exploration up at Arrow River, just up Highway 61 in Thunder Bay, Ontario. And actually, when I was looking at a place to ordain to practice, that's where I decided I was going to go. After visiting all these places, went to Thailand, I decided to go there. But then I sat a retreat, and I actually saw how crazy my mind was, you know, sitting for 3 months. And I said, no, I really need some really serious sort of a training environment for that. Like, Arrow River would have been really wonderful in the sense it would have been a lot of chance to practice meditation. I think that's what inspired me to go there, was to be able to serve and to have time to meditate. But there's more of a training to the whole aspect of, say, monastic training in general. It really is. Even my teacher, Ajahn Pasno, he's been a monk. This year will be 40 years that he's been a monk. And he still talks about it as a training. You know, it's like even though I can't talk about it or know even what his attainments are, but, you know, he still talks about it as, you know, the monastic form is a training. And so, like, even if you were enlightened, you know, you still have to learn skills of how to deal with people and how to deal with new situations or teach people in different, you know, as the years go by, people change and their attitudes change. So it's always, you're always learning. So it's always some sort of aspect of a training happening. But when I came to Abhayagiri, I'd visited many different places, but I decided to actually stay there when one day we were just going through the normal routine of the sort of evening, what we call evening puja. Puja just is sort of like a gathering where you'd, like wind did, light the candles and light incense sometimes and bow to the shrine and do some chanting. And then that's usually like all the elements that would sort of be in a puja, but you can do chanting as well and meditation. So every morning and every evening in the monastery we have what's called a puja, where we come together and just sort of, you know, say bow to the shrine and say pay reverence to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. But one evening, we were just getting ready to, I think it was Ajahn Amaro was getting ready to light the candles, and he just stopped. He just stopped for a second or two, and I noticed this pause. And he put the lighter down. He turned around. And he goes, "Why are we doing this? You know, why are we lighting the candle? You know, what's the significance of that?" And he just gave a little talk about that. You know, what is the significance? What is the, you know, it's just not something that we just do habitually. You know, so there's actually a meaning behind it. And then a couple of days later, he did the same thing. He's like, "Okay, why am I lighting the incense? You know, what does that mean? You know, it's like what?" And then just start taking all the various aspects of our life at the monastery that you could just do habitually, ritually, and sort of really just walking through them. And it really kind of made the whole, all the aspects of our life more real. And so I was really impressed with that. It's just, you know, not, you know, there can be an element of just doing things. And like one aspect of like when you first start the training at the monasteries is we do a lot of chanting. You know, we do what's called these paritta chanting, which is a protective chants. And what you have to do when you're a student and you're learning it, you will have a chant book. I've got one here. But the chant leader will sort of chant out the first, say, like two or three words of the particular chant that we're doing. You have to pay attention and you have to hear exactly what they say. And that will tell you, okay, that's the chant that we're going to do. So it's just, you know, like, just the first few words of your favorite song that everybody joins in. And so the first usually about the first year of being in the training, you know, you hear it and then you spend the next, you know, 20 minutes trying to find which chant that was, and then by the time you find it, they're on to the next one. And so the, you know, part of the training is just to be at ease with being confused, just not knowing what's going on. And so that's actually a valuable part of the training as well. But I think, like in a general, it's really good to really know, you know, like, why are you doing things? One aspect, kind of what I wanted to talk about was, so like today is, say, Visakha Puja, and uh, So this does commemorate, sort of in Indian history, sort of in Indian sort of mythology, or the way, say, Indians hold history is very different than we do in the West. So like in the West, it's like, you know, we want to know on, you know, July 4th, you know, 1776, you know, this was signed by these people and things like that. Well, it's not that way in Indian sort of history, you know, Sri Lankan history probably as well. It's much more like the spiritual essence of sort of what happened is much more important. So like, you know, how that can sort of transform the heart, or, you know, it might be actually, you know, the Buddha gave this particular teaching in this town, and this is what he taught. Like, they might memorize, you know, the teachings themselves, and like, there's, I guess there's towns in India where the Buddha actually did give, say, specific teachings. And everybody in the town, if they're Christian, they're Buddhist, they're Hindus, it doesn't matter, they will have memorized those suttas. It's just sort of like that town has that identity that the Buddha was here. And they might also know teachings of other, like, Jain teachers or other teachers through the years that have come there. So but there's a sort of, their sort of sense of history or their sense of, you know, identity is based on sort of what happened in that area. So so you will get this sort of great reverence for, you know, teachings in that way. But if you look at the Buddhist teachings, it's really hard to, you know, you don't get this sort of sense of, okay, you know, he became enlightened and then he did this the next day, and then he did, you know, this, you know, the first year he did these teachings and the second year he did these. Or you can piece it together to a certain extent, but a lot of it is just there's not a like we would have in Western history, this chronological teachings. But what we do know is from, say, this Visakha Puja, is that it was a full, say again, I say myth, but it's just sort of, this is like the history that's been passed down, the oral history, is that in the full moon of May is when the Buddha was born. And there's a whole, you know, myth story about how, you know, when he was born. Well, first is like his mother had all these sort of mystical dreams of, you know, like seeing a, like an elephant appearing. She had this in her dream, and she had this dream of sort of being taken up into a heaven realm, and then, you know, this was all sort of interpreted that she was going to have a, you know, great being. And then so then when the Buddha to be was born, you know, the myth is that he landed on his feet and was born from his mother's side, and he took seven steps and then raised his hand and said something like, you know, I am the greatest being in the world, and this is my last birth. And, you know, it's like, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. It's hard to know. But you know, the significance, you know, that, you know, this, all of this, you know, he probably was born in the month of May and probably could have even been on, you know, I would say like somebody who does have the sort of spiritual baramis and all the cultivation that it took to become a Buddha probably, you know, was born on the full moon day, so I don't really doubt that. So he's like, so he was born on the full moon day of May. And then he was at the age of 29 is when he sort of had his deciding to leave the palace. And probably most people know the story behind that is that he was decided that, well, he was, you know, sort of having, I don't say doubts, but you know, sort of you know, as, you know, he was getting older and just started having doubts about sort of, you know, the world and, you know, where things were going. And he had his charioteer take him out into the village, and his father had shielded him his entire life from sort of realities, because when he was born they had some astrologers or some seers come and like they check the body for auspicious marks and things like this, and it was prophesized that he would either be one of two things. He would be like a world emperor, who would sort of like conquer all of India and all of the known world, and would be a righteous ruler and sort of, you know, rule with the being gentle and bring sort of world peace at the time. And his father really liked that idea. Mm-hmm. His father had been like a ruler, and he was attracted to that idea. And, but the other prophecy was that he would become a Buddha. someone who would bring the truth to the world and to help people in that way. And so his father didn't want that. So his father had the idea was if he could shield his son from all the suffering in the world, that he wouldn't have that spiritual inclination wouldn't arise in him. And it probably was. That's probably why the Buddha, was able to actually, sort of have the impetus to actually set out, because he had been completely shielded and hadn't seen very much suffering. It's like the stories were like every single night the gardeners would have to go through, and any flowers that were just even starting to wilt, they would take them away. Or if anybody working in the palace was even slightly ill, they weren't allowed to come to work that day. And like he never saw illness, he never saw death, and things like this. And then when he finally sort of snuck out of the palace with his charioteer, then the story is he saw the four heavenly messengers on sort of four different days. He saw a sick person who he'd never seen, and that kind of shocked him and sort of disgusted him. And then saw a corpse, and then saw a sick person? Aging person, that's right. Yeah, an aging person. And then he saw a religious seeker. And the religious seeker was the last person he had seen, and then this kind of intrigued him. And it's interesting, on the day that that the Buddha actually then decided to leave the palace was also the day that his son was born. So the Buddha was married and had a son named Rahula. And I kind of look at that as a really powerful symbol as well. It's like, he's brought in a child into the world, and he's realizing, that there is aging, sickness, and death in the world, and he's just brought a being into this world that's going to have to suffer that exact same fate that he's just realized that he's subject to as well. And so it's like, he wanted to save his child. He didn't want his child to have to go through that. So he decided he needed to find a solution to that so he could provide that to his family. And so then he snuck out of the palace and then started his journey. And it took, I think it was 7 years for him to, on his journey, to once he left the palace, to discover enlightenment. He was 35 when that happened. There's an interesting story there. I don't take this personally, but when there's in the commentaries it says that some Buddhas, when they decide to renounce the world and become Buddhas, it takes them, I think it's like 7 weeks in their journey to become enlightened. Some it takes 7 months, and some it takes 7 years. And it took the Buddha 7 years, and he had to go through these 7 years of austerity, sort of really torturing his body, sort of going out of whack, sort of really doing starving. He almost starved to death in the process. And so he had to go through this painful thing. And the commentary say the reason he had to do that was because in the previous Buddha, the Buddha had been named Jodipalo, which is my name, and he had insulted the previous Buddha and called him a bald-plated ascetic, and didn't want to go see the Buddha. I think it was Dipankara, didn't want to go visit him. And so because of this insult to the Buddha, he had to spend 7 years of insult. But I don't identify with that. But, so and again, that's sort of mythology and stories. But so at the age of 35, though, he did sort of realize enlightenment. And again, that happened on the full moon of May. So the day that discovered enlightenment was a full moon day of May. So this day also commemorates the Buddha's auspicious day of his becoming enlightened. And then he taught for 45 years, sort of just as a wanderer. He never really stayed in any one place. There were a few monasteries that he would, during the rains, when the monsoon seasons, that he would stay at. But for most of the year, even right up to his death, he was always a wanderer, always traveling. But it was at the age of 80 that, on a full moon day of May, that the Buddha, passed into Parinibbana. There's lots of stories about that particular day as well, but they all happen on the full moon of May. So this is called there's the major holidays, at least in Thailand where I've trained, and the lineage that I'm in are say Vaisak, which is, we know this is the Buddha Day, so it commemorates all of those events. Then on the, say, after the Buddha became enlightened, then after he did that, the story goes that once he became enlightened, his first thought was is that the realization that he had come to, it wasn't that it was difficult to understand. He said it was too subtle. It was something very subtle about some consciousness, shift in consciousness that I don't know yet. I couldn't explain it, but he said it was too subtle. So he thought, the world's never going to understand this, and I'll just be vexed because it's too subtle, and I won't be able to explain it. And there was the story goes that there was a Brahma Sahampati, one of the high god, and he overheard the Buddha's thoughts, and he thought, oh no, the world will be lost. And so he came to the Buddha and asked him, and he said, there are beings in the world that the words are, they have little dust in their eyes. They do have wisdom and they will be able to understand these teachings. So please, out of compassion for the world, please teach. And then the Buddha used his psychic powers and scan and realized, yes, there actually are some beings that will understand these teachings. And hopefully, we're some of those. And so he did. He decided to teach. And then at first he was thinking of, like, who am I going to teach? And there were two ascetics that he had gone to in his 7 years. And it turns out, though, that in the period of the week after he'd become enlightened, both of those teachers had died. And so he had the realization that they would be able to understand this, but they didn't. But during the 7 years of his struggle to enlightenment, he had five companions who were helping him sort of along the way, or were also seekers of the way, and they were still doing these really severe ascetic practices. And he had the realization that they actually were wise enough, and they had actually been of companions to him and helped him, that so he would go back and teach them. And they were a couple of like months walk away, and so he just sort of walked in stages. And that's the full moon in July, and that's the beginning of our rains retreat. And so that commemorates the Buddha day. And then the other major holiday is the Dhamma day. I mean, is when the Buddha actually made it to Benares, where these five ascetics were, and he taught the Dhammacakka Sutta, sort of the wheel, turning the wheel of Dhamma. And it's a sort of an explanation of the Four Noble Truths. So he comes to them, and at first they actually reject him. They think, oh, here's, because when he actually left the five ascetics, there's a story of this woman named Sujata, and the Buddha's just about ready to die because of starvation, and this woman comes and offers him a bowl of rice milk, or kind of a pudding. And the Buddha kind of has this realization that, of all of his struggles that he's done to become enlightened, it's just led him to, basically he's going to starve to death. And he has this realization that before that he had lived in luxury, as a prince, and had everything at his command, and that didn't lead to true happiness. And now he tortured himself, and that didn't lead to true happiness. And he's like, okay, there's got to be a middle way. It's not 50% of each, but it's, sort of middle way in terms of you have to put forth effort, but you don't have to torture yourself, and you have to be able to take sustenance, but you don't have to be overindulgent in it. So he decided to actually start eating again, but in moderation. And so when Sujata gave him the rice, the ascetics who were practicing with him thought, he's given up. He's gone back to the luxury. He's eating one meal a day. He's being luxurious. He's sleeping 3 hours a night, so we can't trust him anymore. And so they left him. And this was actually a good fortune to the Buddha, because then it actually gave him time just to sort of, once he got his health back, that he was able to throw himself completely into the practice without having anybody else to have to sort of worry about or to be a distraction. So in many ways it was probably a blessing to the Buddha that they had left him. And then, but they had been of service to him for all these years. So he went back to him. And the story is, as soon as they saw him coming, they made an agreement with themselves. Oh, here comes that fake ascetic, Gotama. Let's not get up and greet him. Let's just ignore him. If he wants to come over here, fine, but let's just not, be be kind to him or anything. And, but they said that once the Buddha approached him, there was just something about his aura that they all rose up and they all went. Someone got some water to wash his feet, and someone took his sitting cloth and set it down and prepared it. And then the Buddha started teaching them. And at first they wouldn't listen to him. But he finally said, he announced to them. He said, the word he knows, it's like the doors to the deathless have been discovered. And listen, and I'll explain it to you. And they were like, they wouldn't listen. And finally, after the third time, he said, have I ever said this before to you? Have I ever said that, the doors to the deathless have been, that basic enlightenment has been realized? And they said, no, you haven't. You haven't said that before. And he says, then he repeated again. He said, okay, listen to what I have to say. And they did. And then the story goes that one of the ascetics actually understood what the Buddha was teaching. And it's interesting because he goes through the Four Noble Truths. And at the very end of it, this monk says, oh, everything that has the condition to arise is the nature to cease. And that was his insight. And that was where he became a stream enterer, sort of the first level of enlightenment. And it's really significant because in all those teachings, the Buddha never said that. So it's like the Buddha knew, oh, he got what he was teaching. And so that was the first time that anybody in the world had actually, in this world anyway, that somebody had become enlightened through the Buddha's teaching. So that's the Dhamma Day that we celebrate. And the other celebration was, I'm not sure, it probably would have been like a year later. So this is in February, the month of February. The Buddha, at this point, had been sort of teaching for a good part of a year. And at that point, he had over 1,000 sort of disciples. And they were all fully enlightened. There's a kind of story for some of the very first teachings, the turning of the wheel, the Dhammacakka, that very first one. That's one of the cardinal teachings. A lot of chanting that we do. That's one of the chants. We also do the teaching of not self. It's called anatta lakkhana, and that's where after he's teaching the five ascetics. See, it's Kundanya was the first one that became a stream enterer. Let's say this is the first level of enlightenment, but he hadn't become fully enlightened. So the story kind of goes that the Buddha was teaching them for about a week, maybe. It's kind of hard to tell, but it's like there's the story that like several of them would go off an alms round while the Buddha was teaching the others, and then one night he gives this teaching on the teaching of not self. And at the end of that teaching, all five of the ascetics become fully enlightened. So that's the first time that there's fully enlightened beings in the world other than the Buddha. And then the third teaching that we teach all the time is called the Fire Sermon. And there were the story kind of goes that there were three brothers kind of in this region that the Buddha went to that were fire worshippers. They were kind of they had long hair ascetics. They were probably naked ascetics like you can still see in India today. And they were called fire worshippers. And he slowly sort of converted each one of the brothers separately. And then between the three of them, they had like 1,000 sort of students, and they all became disciples of the Buddha. And so kind of at the end of this, it kind of makes sense that he would have sort of made... had all of them become disciples. And the Buddha at that point hadn't sort of made any rituals or ceremonies about like when to gather together as a group or anything like that. It was still pretty much very loosely organized. But other ascetics and other sort of religious leaders at that time or groups would observe the full moons were sort of like religious significant kind of days. And so it's not surprising that on this particular full moon of February, all of the ascetics that the Buddha had just sort of converted, or all of them were fully enlightened arahants. It was okay. Well, it's the full moon. Let's just go see the Buddha. And so, spontaneously, without any sort of emails being sent out or any notices, 1,250 fully enlightened beings came to see the Buddha one night. And it's interesting because the teaching that the Buddha gave them was quite short. It's basically, he says, that patience is the supreme austerity. That's kind of like the key part of this whole thing, the teaching that he gives them. forget actually what aspect of it is, but he kind of, you know, tells them too that the you know, to sort of, you know, put forth effort and to not it sounds like he's saying, like, not to be overindulgent in food and sort of things like this. But I've heard the interpretation that these were like fire ascetics and that they were really, really heavy ascetics like he was. And probably what he was telling them was, you know, actually you do need to get at least 4 hours of sleep at night. It wasn't like we kind of take it as like, oh, you should be putting forth more effort or something like that. But he's probably telling them, it's like, it's okay to back off a little bit, you know, to make sure you get enough sleep, make sure you get enough food, and things like that. So it was kind of an interesting teaching for that, the one in February. So those are the three main holidays that they have in all sort of Buddhist calendars. Different countries will celebrate them on different days. It's like the Chinese calendar, I think, is quite different from, say Thailand. And it's like, yeah, it can, very different. And so yeah, they do have different days that they celebrate them on. But they all will celebrate all three of those particular days. The holidays that I know are, say, again from Thailand. And then the other big festival days that are related to, say, Buddhist ceremonies would be the start of the rains retreat. So at the very beginning of the monsoon season. It usually starts the full moon in July, or if there's, say, there's two full moons in July, it's the second one, so it's usually like really late. So it even can start as late as the first week of July or August, but usually, say, July, end of July, August, September, and then into October is what we call the rains retreat. And so usually at the very beginning of that period, there's a little bit of a the entrance into the rains retreat is a little bit of a celebration. And when I first, during my third year as a monk, I went to Thailand. I've been to Thailand before, but I went there, and you know, Bayagiri was just starting, but you know, we had, you know, it wasn't uncommon to have 30 or 40 people sort of show up for occasions and Dhamma talks and things like that, which is, of course, you know, not a huge number, but you know, used to see, you know, people interested in coming. And then I went to Thailand, and I'd never been there for a ceremony day or anything like that. And on that particular day at the beginning of the rains retreat, I think like 15 buses sort of showed up with people from Bangkok, or just people that wanted to just sort of come and be part of it. And just for the food line, when people were coming and offering food, I was like looking down this long line of people, and I was like, you know, there's more people on this line of people that probably had been to a Bayagiri in the entire, you know, 5 years that it existed. It's like the entire history of Bayagiri was, you know, less people had visited the monastery than they were there. So I realized, wow, this is, you know, different. This is a different feel. And it's even a minor holiday, you know, but still thousands, of, you know, hundreds anyway, of people came for the meal offering. Probably a thousand people were there just to, you know, to sort of wish the monks well in the beginning of the rains retreat. And then, so that's another big day. And then the very end of the rains retreat, there's a celebration at the kind of at the end of that for the monastics. It's called a Pawarna day, which is a day that we ask for forgiveness from each other. So that's a really special sort of ceremony, at least within the monastic group, sangha. But also too, lots of people come to the monastery on that day. And then the Buddha allowed a ceremony called a katina. And it's for any monastery anywhere that's had at least, I think it's four or five monks who've participated in the rains retreat in that particular monastery, then there's a ceremony where the lay people can offer the cloth, basically to the monastics. This was during the time of the Buddha. You know, cloth wasn't very easy to come by, and so it was kind of a prized item or very valuable. And the monks would, because most of them all the time would be wandering, and this time would be bhikkhunis, nuns as well. And you know, they would, during the rains retreat, it was difficult to travel just because it was, if you were, you'd be damaging the roads and damaging the crops, and that's when the farmers would have been really busy anyway. It was the rains during the monsoon seasons. So the Buddha and all the other different ascetics of that time, other religions, they didn't travel during that time either. So initially, the Buddha didn't have a rule about not traveling during that time. And he got criticized for it. So he's like, yeah, well, that's actually right. So he established the rains period. And then, so what happened, as you can imagine, is, you know, a group of people would sort of gather in Minneapolis and start practicing here for 3 months, and you would get to know them and support them, and they would benefit from your generosity, and you might receive teachings from them and benefit from that. So when it was, when they would leave, it was like, you know, you got to know them, they were your friends. And so it was like this sense of the people wanted to support the monastics when they left, and wanted them to have, you know, new robes or something like that, which would last probably for, you know, just the next year, and then they would be pretty rotten at the end of the year, kind of living in the tropics. And so it was this really beautiful ceremony to support any monastics that were practicing. And so that's the, in Thai culture, that's probably like this, I mean, today is the biggest sort of religious ceremony. Then the Katina is like it's the second biggest, and it's almost as big. And it's really beautiful, if you live in the monastery, it's a really beautiful ceremony where the people will come, and the monastics can't ask for it, so they can't. We couldn't sort of say, you know, Tom, we'd really like you to offer the Katina this year. It has to be completely spontaneous, and usually people are fighting over who gets to do it. Like it's a really, really sort of meritorious or prized sort of thing to do, and so people, usually it's like a group of people get together and do it, and they'll offer cloth, and it's a really simple sort of ceremony, and then you take the cloth, and then the monastics have to sew it into a robe before dawn the next day. And so we take it in, and we've got it all sort of figured out. Where you know, like if right now at Abayagiri, there's about, I think, 16 community members there, and so we have a sort of a sheet of like, okay, these are all the different aspects of how you have to sew the robe and how to do it. And so everybody has an aspect of it. So everybody gets together and makes a robe. Lately, we've gotten pretty efficient with it, and we might start sewing about 2 in the afternoon, when the kind of ceremony ends after the meal. And we're usually done by about 9, so it takes about 7 hours to sew a, not this robe, but the lower one, which is almost exactly like this one. But then, so we sew it, and then the community decides that one person in the community will receive the robe. So it's this real honor to get it. Usually goes to the abbot, but not always. There's sometimes some individual will have, you know, taken on a lot of teaching responsibilities or done some, you know, really good service to the Sangha. Usually, someone who's a little bit more senior in the Sangha, and they'll receive that robe. And so it's this really beautiful ceremony of the whole community coming together and working on a project, and then giving it to a particular community member. So those are like the main, say, I would say, like, holidays and celebrations, of course, in all of the like in Thailand especially, but I think all Southeast Asian countries, you know, they have a like, say, Thai New Year's. It's called Songkram there. If you've ever, you know anything about Thai culture, you know, it's like, it's the water festival. So you see all these things with people with water cannons and sort of spraying people on the streets, and it becomes a real kind of fun kind of party kind of atmosphere. Things like that. So that's another big, big festival for Thai. And on that particular day, and at least it used to always happen. We have some photographs or some films of this happening with the abbot of Abayagiri, Hajin Pasano, where they would actually bathe. Well, I have one picture. I'll actually show it later. I'll just point it out. But it's of it's a day where we sort of wash it's called washing the Buddha, so it is on the Thai New Year. And so one aspect, the way we do it in America, is that we'll have a Buddha image, and then people come and just pour water on top of it. And so that's sort of the whole day. But they used to, in Thailand, what they would do is, here, this photo right here, it's one of the Anagarika, as you can see the Buddha there. And it's been done up really beautiful with flowers and things like that, and it's just sort of the ceremony of just pouring the water on the Buddha. And, and so, but that comes from the sort of the Thai New Year of just sort of, you know, this festival of, it's kind of like renewal, and, you know, it's like it's the a new year, kind of washing away you know, not as like washing away your sins, but this sort of is like starting clean, starting fresh, and has that kind of connotation to it. And so that's, but what they did in the early days of what, say, Wapanachat, and this has probably happened for centuries before that, but they would they have this, what they did for modesty's sake, but they have the senior monk would just be sitting in a towel basically wrapped around his waist, and then they have this sort of petition, and that everybody would come over and sort of pour water on this trough, and it'd be freezing cold water, and you'd come down and pour on top of the abbot's head, and then there'd be a few men in there, and they'd sort of be scrubbing him, so everybody's giving the abbot of the monastery a bath. And that's sort of the you know, everybody found it really fun, and then of course everybody would get into a water fight themselves, and so it's just a sort of, again, sort of an opportunity for a kind of a party kind of thing. So that's a kind of another holiday. So those are the events or the days, but I kind of want to talk a little bit about sort of, you know, like how to use these skillfully, how to use them in ways that actually are aids to our meditation practice. And you know, like one thing I mentioned, you know, sort of like just the shrine element itself. We have the, you know, candles. We have like, say, tapered candles, incense, and flowers will be on the shrine. And you know, so just really kind of, you know, generally, it's just like the candles. I've heard different interpretations from different people, but usually the candles sort of, well, the whole shrine itself. Of course, the central image is the Buddha image. And so the image itself is representing wisdom. You know, the word Buddha itself actually means to be awake. That's what Buddha or Buddha means, is to be awake. So it's like our highest aspiration. You know, to be awake to what's happening in our lives, to be awake to our feelings, our emotions. You know, just to be mindful. So that's sort of why that's why we put that in the center. It does mean also the historical person who was the Buddha, who's sort of having gratitude that he did want to teach, that he didn't just keep it to himself, that, you know, he actually did do the work over all of his lifetimes to become a Buddha, and there's, you know, just reverence for the teachings that he taught. So the central image is the Buddha. And then the candles represent sort of wisdom. So it's like the light, you know, the light of wisdom. And you can also sort of, you know, see impermanence there, how the candles burn down, and, you know, kind of how fragile it is too. You know, the candles can be blown out if we don't give it careful attention. But they represent, the central image is, for them is wisdom. Then the incense, it's when you light incense, it has usually has a very beautiful smell, but also it just burns it, like, say, you know, it's a candle, it's kind of, you know, it flickers and it's bright, and sometimes it's actually too bright to look at, which, you know, wisdom can be that way. But the incense burns, but it's just at one single point, and you can actually sort of, you can look at that, and so that's the one pointedness of concentration of samadhi. So the incense is representation of concentration, and also the sweetness of it is that, you know, there is a sweetness when you are concentrated. There's a, you know, some purity of that, and then the flowers are similar, just the fragrance of that. But that's the sila aspect, morality, the sort of, again, beautiful smell of somebody who's who's practicing well, and there's a safety, you know, that comes from being around somebody who, you know, is not trying to take advantage of you, or, you know, trying to get something from you, or do anything wrong in the world. You can really trust that kind of person. There's that sort of sense of, you know, fragrance that comes from that. And I really like the fact that sort of Ajahn Amaro, he was, you know, lighting the candle. Like, you know, why are we doing that? So it's, you know, that is the imagery there. But just lighting a candle doesn't mean anything, or lighting the incense doesn't mean anything. It's something that we actually have to bring our minds to. It actually has to be something that we cultivate. So it's so one aspect of when we are doing, you know, setting up the shrine for the puja, for the ceremony, is that we come in and we bow three times to the shrine, to the Buddha image, and to the shrine. And again, there's nothing happens in the bowing. It's like, in the Tibetan tradition, they have, you know, sometimes it's, you know, to go into a formal meditation retreat or something like that, they have to do like 10,000 or 100,000, you know, body prostrations. That's really part of the whole aspect. But there's nothing like mystical that happens there. It's not that the, you know, what we do in the Theravada tradition is a very simple, you know, just three bows, but it does, you know, like we can do that entire lives and not be any wiser for it. And so we have to actually, you know why we're doing it, and it's just this reminder to quiet the mind. So it's like what we do in the monastery is like every time we enter into the shrine room where the Buddha image is, anytime we enter into our cabin, we most of us have individual cabins. Sometimes we might have to share a room or something like that, but we all have Buddha images in our shrines, in our cabins, and any place we're going in where we're going to be practicing, if there's a Buddha image there, the first thing we do is we set our belongings down, and it's just to quiet your mind. It's just to really consciously, okay, whatever I was thinking about, whatever I was doing, whatever I'm planning to do when I get into this room, just drop that. And the bowing itself is just this anchor point to allow you to remember to do that and to just bow. And if you do that like every single day, you know, you can get into this habit, or just a, you know, it's not a ritual, but a, you know, just the habit, or not using it skillfully, you can just sort of come into the room. 1, 2, 3, it's time to eat. You know, 1, 2, 3, let's meditate. You know, and if you're doing it that way, it's almost like more like superstition. You're like, okay, this is a rule that I have to do. Like, you know, you have to do this before you meditate, and that then it doesn't really become an aid for meditation, for stilling the mind. So it's, again, something you have to very consciously, you know, bring to your mind and want to do that and actually see the benefit of it, which is to just quiet and still the mind. And if you do that, then, of course, if you, you know, you get back to your cabin and you still the mind, then it's okay, now let's meditate. Or you get into the shrine room, okay, then let's, you know, then, okay, I've set that aside. It's much more peaceful, not thinking about whatever I was thinking about. And then when you go into the puja, it gives you just much more of an opportunity to be present for what you intended to do. So that's the sort of the element of the bowing. And when you do that, then when you stop and you bow, then you can sort of, you know, just take in the elements of the shrine and remember that. Okay, yeah, that, you know, as the whoever it is, the teacher, senior monk or nun is lighting the candles, you can just reflect on that. Okay, that's the aspect of wisdom. And then they light the incense, and then you can just bring that to mind. So it's these are like sort of touch points that you can come back to continually to remember that these are aspects that we want to cultivate in our lives, and we want to aspire towards. One thing that maybe I'll get into some of these slides here now. These initial ones here. That's a good one to start. Let's just start right there. One thing about sort of ceremonies and rituals is I was just going through the photos a couple of days ago, just preparing for this, and they had, you know, there's probably like 100 pictures someone had taken of this particular ceremony, and I saw this one and I was like, yeah, this is actually a big part of what ritual and what ceremony is about, is that probably a dozen people, not everybody's in the photograph there, but a dozen people came together just to make the ritual items, sort of like just gathering the flowers and gathering the incense and the candles, and they make it up into this really beautiful sort of bouquet. And then they probably spent all afternoon. It was a little, you know, opportunity for people to meet new people and to gather and to work together as a community. So let's go back to the first one. And so this was taken the day before the U.S. went into Iraq. We had there was a world sort of peace sort of, you know, gathering in many, many places all over the world. And so they were, you know, sort of praying for world peace on this particular day. And you can see the various sort of, you know, elements of a puja or ritual. Ritual. And so they got the candles in these little cups. Here they don't have the flowers, but I think in the next photo they will. But you can see, go back to the first one there. You can see in the foreground people have chanting books. So oftentimes in a puja or ritual, they'll be, say, bowing to the shrine. But there's also chanting. And I've got a really nice story about that. I was listening to Ajahn Viradano, who's up in Ottawa, and he was saying that a few years ago, somebody in his particular sangha died of cancer, and he was with them when they really started getting really bad, and the cancer had entered into their bones, and then really shortly after that, it entered into the blood system. And before that, he could talk to her, and she could rationally understand what he was saying. But as soon as the cancer entered into the blood system, it just she couldn't rationally. There was too much pain, and he could tell that she was in a lot of fear. And so any explanations he was giving her, any sort of instructions to try to calm down, wasn't registering. Just her brain wasn't working that way anymore. And he said he just spontaneously just started chanting. He started doing the chanting that they do at the monastery all the time, the morning or evening chanting. And he said she immediately connected with it, and she just immediately calmed down because she had been practicing this ritual, the ritual of chanting. And so it actually had some meaning for her. It always meant to her peace and calm, and so how she would prepare her mind for meditation. So as soon as she heard it, it's not an intellectual aspect. It's a heartfelt sort of aspect. And so, I love this photo because it has all those elements. It has the chanting, has the candles, has the community, and everybody's in a circle. So there's this all the sort of ritual that way. Let's go on to the Nikudan. Just here's. And what we normally do, on these particular days, is we would do a circumambulation either around a Buddha image or a meditation hall. And so we'd light the candles and just do three circles around say the building. And in each time you go around, you would just sort of be with your intention to sort of just either just going through Buddha, 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 just thinking of the Buddha, reflecting on all the qualities of the Buddha, being awake, and the gratitude for the teachings. And then the second one, you'd go around and be doing Dhammo, 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 keeping the Dhamma in mind. And then the second one, the third round would be the Sangha, so just reflecting on community and the support we get from everybody's practicing together. And so as you walk around the image, you'd be carrying the candles and incense. Okay, next one. And then at the end of it, we depending on how many people there, we just have a receptacle form. It's really beautiful. You might have a couple hundred candles sort of all burning on these steps that lead up to another Buddha image up on the hill. And, okay, next one. Okay, next one. Yeah, and that's the one of the ceremonies for, say, the Thai New Year. Next one. Yeah, I really like this one. This is one of the senior monks at Abhayagiri. This is another ceremony, and he has a blessing cord. And it's just one of the little girls that her mother comes to the monastery all the time. And I just really like that picture. It just shows that a lot of the rituals and things are really family-based. It's like the whole family comes to these. It's just not... kind of in the West, we go off and do individual meditation retreats, and it's not just about us because we have to leave our families and things like that. But in a lot of these ceremonies and rituals, the whole family comes, and they'll be there most of the day. Of course, the kids go off and do what kids do and play and stuff like that, but they oftentimes really appreciate the ceremonies as well. Okay, next one. Now this was, we did our circumambulation by gearing, we could do it single file, but this is at Wapapong, the monastery where Ajahn Chah was. And this is just probably any one of the festival days. It'll be like this. It'll be 5,000 lay people will come to the monastery on that particular day. It might be 2,000 or 3,000monks coming. Their circumambulation path, as you can imagine, is much bigger. It might be like a quarter mile circle and stuff like that, but there'll be all these people. And it's a really beautiful, beautiful ceremony, these ceremonies. I have a video here. I don't know if I'll show it. I might show it later if anybody wants to stick around and watch it, but it's of Ajahn Chah's funeral. And a million people came to his funeral. And there's this kind of scene where actually the king and queen of Thailand came to pay respects to his body, and they ceremonially lit the funeral pyre. And then he comes out, and it shows the scan of people, and it just thousands and thousands of people that were there. And it's really peaceful and really calm, and it's just really powerful to see just the devotion and the, that sort of communal harmony and coming together for something like a funeral, doesn't it? Yeah. Funeral or any of the Buddhist holidays. Let's go on to the next one. And this is this ceremony here would have been Ajahn Chah's commemorating his passing away. So they have a circumambulation, and again, like 10,000 people might show up on that particular day, and that's the big spire in the center there is when they cremated Ajahn Chah, his body turned into crystals, mm-hmm. and most of his body parts are in that shrine. So the monks have circumambulated the shrine three times, and then if you can get in, then you go in and put your flowers there at the shrine. And that's what's happening in this ceremony here. Okay, next one. And there's lay people coming through after the monks have come through first. And next one. And here's, it probably got two full insides, so people were just lining the flowers that they had around the outside. You can just imagine. Actually, I was listening to a talk too, kind of preparing for this one, and sort of things with ritual. It's like this particular monk was in England giving this talk, and an old talk, but it's like when Princess Di had died in England, and just lots of people came to the funeral, and I remember seeing pictures like this, just 5 foot, 10 foot wall of flowers, just a stretch forever. It was just real, a very skillful, wholesome way for people to come together to sort of, deal with grief, actually realizing that it's not, grief isn't always an individual thing. So it's like, if it's your partner or your loved one that dies, there's other people that are involved in that as well. And, sort of seeing, it enables you to have a container to be able to deal with that grief. I think with Ajahn Chah's passing away now, that was 20 years ago. It's more of a joyous sort of occasion now. But, so this is sort of commemorating someone's passing away. And I was thinking the same thing when this monk was talking about that Princess Di. I wasn't even alive. But like when JFK passed or was assassinated, the images I've seen of the mourning and the sort of really beautiful ritual of how it was all done in a really beautiful way. It just gave the nation a focus for dealing with the grief. So ritual can do be very healing in many ways. Is there any more, John? So this is at Abayagiri. This is one of our outdoor shrines. We call this the ordination platform. So this is where we do most of our sort of circumambulations. If the weather's good, there's a path that goes completely around it, probably about a 200-foot sort of circumambulation path. And that's this is probably just like our morning or evening puja. So we gather every morning in the summertime and sit outside. Gather at 5 in the morning and then again at 7 in the night. And just go through the chanting, and there's candles and incense and all that. We do that every day. Yeah.
The white robes.
Yeah, those are their beginning. We call them Anagarikas. So those two are. They've taken on the 8 precepts, and it's a training for one year. And if they wish to go on, they would become novices. So the monk who's in the very very far back, you can see like he doesn't. Most of the monks there have a robe over their left shoulder. And so they're fully ordained monks, but the ones there's, you can see two in the picture that don't have a robe over their shoulder. Kind of one on the far right, second one from the far right, and the one on the far left in the back. Those are both novices. And so that's the only way you can tell if someone's fully ordained or a novice. Novices will usually be at the very end of the line. If they have all the robes on, they won't have that third robe over their shoulder. And then the novices follow 10 precepts, which is basically not using money. And then if you choose to go on further, then we have 227 precepts as fully ordained monks. So we can go on to the next one. I like this photo because this is actually the man in white. He's becoming a novice, and the one who's in brown is going to become a bhikkhu. So it's a sort of they had the ceremonies together with them. But the center monk right in front of the Buddha, that's my teacher, Ajahn Pasano. And then to his left is a Chinese monk. He comes to Minneapolis quite a lot. Is a Reverend Hung Shir, and he's a really good monk. So I should let Mark know if somebody comes here. He'd be wonderful to have here. He's really into music and puppets. He uses puppets for Dhamma talks. And he's very skilled with them. And you probably find very fascinating to Ajahn Pasano, right, that's Bhikkhu Bodhi. So if you've ever read Majjhima Nikaya or the Digha Nikaya and Guttara Nikaya, all the translations, that's Bhikkhu Bodhi. We owe a big debt of gratitude to him. So he's in terms of Buddhist scholarship and understanding of the Buddhist teachings, he's a good friend of our community. Okay, next slide. And this is just later on in a particular bhikkhu ordination. Just sort of showing the ceremony of it. Is that it? Yeah, back to the end. So I just wanted to just kind of show. I like starting off with those pictures of a Bhayagiri. Sort of looks really beautiful, the candles, the incense, and you're all going around in a circle. And then you show the picture of Thailand, and there's 10,000 people there. It's just like, okay, different scale in Thailand. But, so I didn't really have any particular plan of what I wanted to cover tonight. I knew I'd cover something. And, I guess I wanted to open it up for questions, if anybody has any questions. Maybe the slideshow may have sparked some questions, didn't you? So if anybody has any questions. Yeah, Tom?
Jim Paul, I wondered if you've ever heard this version of the Siddhartha transformation. But Karen Armstrong, who's, I normally respect her as a Christian researcher, I heard her say that these four different people that Siddhartha saw when he went out were actually brought into him, that his father actually brought them into the palace. He didn't go out looking. They were brought to him so he could see. Have you ever heard that before?
No. Was that in the book The Buddha?
Pardon me?
Was that in her book called The Buddha?
I'm not sure. I just heard her saying this on the radio, so I don't know if she has it written anywhere.
Yeah. No, I've never heard that. I've always heard it the opposite way, because I mean, in terms of the myth of the story, it wouldn't make any sense, because right. The Buddha was, his father was trying to shield him from all of that. Yeah. So no, I've never. It may have happened that way. She might have an inside source that we don't. It's like different traditions and. Especially sort of like you said, the three major different schools of Buddhism, Theravada, Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. So they do have different versions of a lot of these different stories. So I don't, as I was sort of talking about it, I mean, I hold these stories very reverentially, and to me it's like, if it did happen or didn't happen isn't because it is, it's more the meaning behind it, the story of how do you use that. So it's like, the Buddha, if he took 7 steps or, that doesn't really matter to me, because it is pointing to, though, that he was a great being and that he, did come into the world to end suffering for many beings. So it's like, I can look at it and the symbology of it that way.
I just wanted to thank you for coming, and I really enjoyed the talk. And I noticed just how my mind settled down just in hearing you speak Yeah, and maybe it's the stories, too. The stories are always nice to hear. Mm-hmm. But I also felt like I was just picking up on some of your samadhi. So I was just wondering if you could talk at all about just, you know, bringing samadhi into daily life and how that's maybe, you know, maybe it's easier, hopefully, for mm-hmm. you now than it was. But just, because I really feel that from you, this, and it's helped just my mind just in this talk, just that sense of, yeah, it's okay, just, and bringing that just even while talking, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, like the formal practice that we do, so like, you know, being on retreat or, you know, I just did come off of a longer retreat, and so that might, you know, who knows if, you know, something's being transmitted or I'm just speaking more gently, you know, I don't know. But the, so like, I spent the last 3 months really diving in really deeply with the metta as a meditation object. So I hope you all come tomorrow because I'm really excited about talking about that topic. But that was like my main focus. And, you know, it's, yeah, for 3 months. And there were times where the mind was settled and focused and, you know, enjoyed it. And there were, you know, vast majority of the times it wasn't. You know, it was just mindfulness practice, just keeping the mind on the object of the meditation. And you don't really kind of worry about the results if it gets concentrated or not. You're putting forth the effort. And so that's a lot of what the formal practice is. But I've noticed that, so we've been off retreat now for 2 months. We were on for three, and then we've been off for two. And then now we're back into, you know, building the monastery and, you know, a lot more interactions with people now and traveling and things like that. But what I have noticed is it's like, you know, the amount of effort that I put into during the retreat, that sort of, you know, any calmness that I did get from that, I'm noticing really, really strongly that it carries over. You know, you do get, say, benefits from the concentration practice, and, you know, it does sort of, you know, settle the mind, or this makes it softer. And so, like, I've been noticing lately, it's like, you know, I noticed the mind, you know, before the retreat started, before I really did a lot of meditation practice. And, you know, there might be something where someone comes up and says something to you, like they might be rushed or you misinterpret it and think it's really rude what they said or something like that. And, you know, before that would have been sort of like, you know, ooh, that kind of hurt. You know, this sort of, you kind of react to it, or you may not say anything, but you sort of feel this sort of tightening in the chest or something. But then after doing, say, 3 months of this really formal practice, it's like now that the retreat is over and, you know, someone does that exact same thing, it's like I'm noticing in my mind now, it's just sort of like, oh, he's really suffering. You know, it's not the sort of sense of like, you know, I need to protect myself or he's wrong or he's bad, but it's just this much more, so, you know, it's much more gentleness in the mind. And so it's like, so like right now, like I'm not, you know, I'm still doing the loving kindness practice, but it's like it's not getting anywhere near the concentration level that I would have during the retreat, and so I think, like, so how do you take that samadhi practice, you know, into the daily life? It's like a certain level you don't,
yeah,
because it's like there's a, it's, you know, it comes under certain causes and conditions. And so what I kind of see is, it's like what I feel like daily life is that's the preparation. Daily life is the preparation for when you do go into concentration practice. So it's like how skillfully I live my life. So for the next 7 months, because in 7 months' time we'll go back into a 3-month retreat. We do January, February, March is our formal time of meditation practice. And there'll be other times we'll have a couple of weeks or a month here or there, but they're usually like 2-week periods. But I just see, like, more and more, it's like, you know, how skillfully I follow my precepts, how, you know, gentle I am with the people around me and things like that. That has a great influence than when I go into to do formal meditation practice. Because it's like, yeah, the more gentle you've been, the more sort of effort you put into the practice, even if it's just, like, say if I'm doing loving kindness practice now, it's like most of the time I don't connect with the object at all, you know, very, very strongly, but it's just there's a particular pattern or way you do it of going through phrases and things like that. So if I spend an entire hour just going through the phrases, even though I may not, you know, connect with the feeling, I don't feel like that was a waste of meditation, because like I stayed with that meditation object for a whole hour. And in some levels, that's concentration, even in itself. So, yeah. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Maybe building on that, with the Does doing the rituals as a community, does that kind of help too when you get into that interaction? I mean, if you're living in a close community with people, mm-hmm. it seems like the possibility for friction are greater, and mm-hmm. does it, maybe it's a question of which helps more, the mindfulness or the fact that you've built this mm-hmm. kind of ritual and community that way to kind of mm-hmm. diffuse the tension that might otherwise be there?
Yeah. That's a good question. I would definitely say that the sort of, you know, all the common aspects of our life, you know, help us to live together. For one thing, it's like, you know, if we were just a group of, say, 20 individuals who just said, you know, let's just get together and meditate, but then, you know, so like, but, you know, say half the community members wanted to, say, raise goats and chickens, and the other half wanted to, you know, just be a, you know, like more like a monastery where that's not happening. So, you know, there's tension there. So just having this, you really, that's one thing about, say, like ritual or just something about bowing. It's like, you know, there's a particular way that we do it in the Thai forest tradition, or maybe even Bayagiri's way of doing this may be different from other, even in our Chali. We have a particular way that we do it, and so it's a. You're just putting yourself into that particular form, you know. There's nothing in, say, there's nothing in the bow, and there's nothing in the form itself that actually, you know, is really. There's nothing in it that's magical or is any transform anything. But it's how your mind reacts to it, and so, so I think like the same way. It's like the beautiful thing about actually living in, say, a monastery, is that no one there is asked to be there. So it's like no one, you know, sort of came up to you and said, Jane, we really want you to come be an Anagarika. You know, it's like, you know, you would come to us and say, you know, I'd like to, you know, start the training, you know, can I be there? And so, you know, partly it's really beautiful because if you ask to come and do it, then you can't blame us when things get difficult. Because no, you asked to be here, you asked to be the guest. And so that really allows you to drop a lot of it, you know, so it's like you don't blame other people, but it's like you actually take responsibility for being there. But then having everybody sort of being on the same page, like, okay, we do have morning puja at 5 a.m., we do have a work period from 7 to 11, and, you know, however the schedule is, you know, it's like, you know, it can feel like at times like I'm a, you know, I actually haven't had this thought for a long, long time, but it's like you can't feel like you're a prisoner in the monastery. You know, it's like, you know, you have to do this because this is the schedule. But the thing is, you don't have to. You know, it's like we haven't signed any agreement. There's no contract. It's like, you know, it's like, you know, I'm there because I choose to be there. And so that actually forces you to. Well, I was really impressed. This last year, we had attending a conference with the Catholic monks. Buddhist Catholic monks got together and we were talking, and you know, they take not only, you know, it's not only lifetime vows that they take, but it's also they take vows to their community. So it's like in Bayagiri, like I ordained with my teacher Ajahn, and basically I made an agreement with him that I would listen to him for the first 5 years. And I would, you know, say whatever you sort of advise me, but after that, if he says I'm well enough trained, then I'm no longer under dependence of him. Respectfully, I will still, as long as he's alive, I will always do what he asks me to do. But I, you know, like there's really no commitment. Like if I wanted to, I could go off to Thailand, you know, tomorrow. So I'm senior enough to do that. But in the Catholic tradition, the Christian tradition, you know, they take vows of stability. And we started talking about that with that group, and it's just like it's really, really powerful, because it's like, you know, their communities are dwindling for one thing. So it's like, you know, you might live with, say, you know, say 10 or, you know, say, you know, 50 other monastics, and if you don't like somebody, you know, you've taken a vow to be with that community. It's like you might have to spend the rest of your life with that person. You know, it's the only community of 10, so it really forces them to get over their issues, you know, to really work them through, and you know, sort of, you know. And we were really impressed with that, you know, because in our tradition, it's like, yeah, if you don't like somebody, you can sort of bite your lip, and you know, they'll leave or you'll leave, and you know, there's turnover and stuff like that, and so, you know, in some ways, you can dodge it and not have to deal with it, but even, you know, at a certain level, you can't either, because it's like, you know, even though we do have that ability to travel, it's, you know, you can see that by dodging it and things like that, but it's, you know. you're creating dukkha for yourself. You know, there's suffering in that. If you're really honest with yourself, then you would certainly try to find ways to do it. And I think just having all those commonalities, it's like many times in the monastery, and it's not that way right now for me, but there are many times when there's not a single person in the monastery who I would have considered to be like a friend if I was out in the world. They weren't the type of people that I'd go to a movie with or, go. None of them were interested in what the Minnesota Vikings were doing. But there are a few now who are interested. There's one right there. But we got together all winter retreat and talked about sports. My little help. Sorry, Kevin, for putting you out there. But... So there come times when there's actually nobody in the community that you would really be friends with, but it's like it doesn't matter, because it's like I know that everybody in that monastery is there because they want to end suffering, and that's like my biggest value, and so even though like socially I wouldn't hang out with them, it's completely easy to want to be with them and to practice with them and to support them and be supported by them. So in the rituals hall. I'll help them out, because it gives us that we're all facing the same direction.
Does that forgiveness ceremony kind of help that process
too? Yeah, it does too, yeah. Mm-hmm. Did I give a talk on that here? That asking for yeah, I've given several talks on that. That's one of my favorite subjects, is the asking forgiveness ceremony. Don't have time to get into it right now. Any other... Maybe I do have time to talk about it. Yeah.
Did you refer to the Catholic Buddhist monks? Is that what you said?
It was a Catholic monk, Buddhist monk. So it's a dialogue that is actually sponsored by the Catholic Church, where they get together with other religious groups, and so it's called intermonastic dialogue. So yeah, it's two different groups. No.
I thought you said they were.
Buddhist Catholics. You are ex-Catholics who are now Buddhist. Yeah. No, it's several of the monks that attended are from St. John's over in Collegeville. I'm really good friends with one of the senior monks there. Actually, when I leave here, I'm going down to Chicago to go stay for a couple nights at a St. Procopius Monastery outside Chicago from just one of the monks that I met. In that dialogue, he's the same age I am, so it's nice to know a Catholic monk who's actually young. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's like at Abaye Giri, there's a they're actually Eastern Orthodox. They're from Ukraine, but I don't know exactly the whole history of it. But they split from their church about 800 years ago, and they're actually Catholic, even though they have all the full beards and they look just like they're out of Ukraine, all the architecture and most of their ceremony stuff, but they're under the auspices of Rome. And the vice abbot there was very liberal. And one of our sort of rituals or ceremonies is every week we stay up all night long, once a week, and we stay up and meditate all night long. And we finish our last ceremony for the morning chanting about 3:30. And so I just made a vow just not to go to sleep that in the next 2 hours. And so I would walk over to their monastery and I'd go to their morning puja, which would start at 4. And then so all the monks there got to know me really well. And I remember when, sort of just having this realization, it's like, because when I grew up, I had never seen a monk, Christian or Buddhist. And there's a sort of thought, it's like, I totally disagree with, not totally disagree, but I don't really connect with the Catholic teachings or Christian teachings, but if I had met this lifestyle, like before I met Buddhism, there's a very good chance that I could have become a monastic, because there's some part of me is really attracted to the monastic form. And so we get together at these conferences with Catholic monks that we find that we have so much in common. It's really incredible. We don't get together to debate theology and stuff like that. It's really, and most of the times, both sides will come away saying, I really, really appreciate hearing the way you practice. And the thing I come away with is, I'm really glad I'm a Buddhist. even though it's our practices are similar, but it's quite fun.
Learn a lot from each other that way.
Yes.
is part of your work when you're at your monastery, do you leave the monastery and go out in the community and work with people? Or I'm just curious as to...
Yeah. Ajahn Chandoko, we have a pretty good website where we have Dhamma talks and stuff like that. And Ajahn Chandoko was out of Aigiri last year, and he gave this really wonderful talk on social activism. And his hope I'm accurate on this, but he sort of said, you know, the most sort of radical thing we can do in America is make a monastery. So that's our social activism, is really creating, you know, spaces that people can come to get away from the rat race of the world, and to have a place where it's, you know, the focus is, you know, not you know, no televisions, no news, no, you know, just for places where people can come and practice. And so, you know, that's how we support people in the communities. And
so, are there retreats there that
people? We don't in the monastery. We when I first got there, like, I would sometimes be listening, I'd be in the office, and somebody would be answering the phone, and I hear him say, "No, we don't offer retreats." And I'd always say, "Don't say that. Tell them we offer the 5-year retreat." You know, it's like, it's not a retreat about concentration or being silent, but it's like, you know, so when you come to the monastery, it's like you just plug into the life. And that in itself is a retreat. You know, it's like it's right livelihood, it's right in, right effort, right, you know, all the Eightfold Path is there. You know, right intention, right speech, and right action. It's learning, say, you know, Buddhism in a way other than sort of the retreat mode. And but we do for our community. We at least once a year, sometimes two times a year. One of the senior monks will go in and offer like a 10-day or a 2-week retreat, and usually we do teachings at Spirit Rock. So before Ajahn Amaro, when he's now in England, he's taken over for Ajahn Sumedho. He retired and is living in Thailand now. Ajahn Amaro went over and is taking over. So it's a little harder for us to do those kind of teachings, just because, you know, he was such a valuable Dhamma teacher. But so occasionally we'll still do like 10-day retreats at Spirit Rock, and so we do them there. We just don't have the facilities at where we are. It's a rugged, really rugged piece of land.
So if we come to visit you, we would come to stay.
Yeah, and we'll put you to work. No, but you're welcome. Everybody's welcome to come. It's just, if you wanted to come and just sort of participate, yeah, we have a website that you can go to, and you can contact the guest master and things like that. Usually it's about a week the first time get visitors and come to. You know, actually last summer, I think it was every single week of the year, there was someone from Common Ground that was there. I was really surprised. I'd just be sitting there, and I'd hear this sort of Minnesota accent, you know, and I'd just go up to him and go, "You're from Common Ground, aren't you?" And they'd say, "How did you know?" I think that's true. Actually, for like 2 or 3 months, there was someone from here who practiced here. Was it by Gary? Hasn't been any. Maybe I think 2 people have been this year. So. Yeah.
Could you say something, Monte, about the relationship of your community to the bhikkhunis and bhikkhuni ordination?
Yeah. So the first thing is Ajahn Pasno, who's the abbot. He's actually, I don't know exactly what the organization's called, but it's sort of like the support group for the bhikkhunis. He's actually like the president of the order. And so, coming from Thailand, it's really kind of tricky with the politics and all of that. And so he's always been wanting to be very supportive of the bhikkhunis in the United States. And he attended one of the first ordinations in California, and he actually didn't even participate in the ceremony itself. Like, he wasn't part of the what's called the quorum and stuff like that, but he was in attendance, and he got a lot of negative feedback from the authorities in Thailand. And so he just, you know, like, okay, we're going to support them, but we're going to support them from behind the scenes. So it's like, you know, financial support and teaching support and things like that. So we're really fortunate in California. There's two nuns communities, Aranya Bodhi and I forget the other one. Aranya Bodhi is the nuns from Amaravati. There were two nuns there in the Sila Dra order, and they became bhikkhunis, fully ordained bhikkhunis. Then there's another one kind of in that same area, that Ayatata Tiloka. She was the one of the senior nuns in America, and she has a community. And so, yeah, we try to support them as much as we can in that way. Both of those communities come to Abhayagiri and receive teachings, and we go there. And, you know, I've been to both of their places myself. So that's our connection so far. Yeah, it's the early days, and so things are changing, and so we hope is that as people become more familiar with it, and at the beginning people can have closed views and shut off to things, but if you do it in a gentle and just sort of support the ways you can, and hopefully attitudes will change. I was just telling somebody, especially this morning, that like when I first came to the monastery, it's like, when someone asked the question, just about bhikkhuni ordination, the standard question was, it just doesn't exist. It wasn't like a judgment or anything like that. It was just, the order died out 800 years ago. It just doesn't exist. And, so the theory was, it's like, well, how do we support women in practice? So it's like Lumbar Sumedho and Hajin Suchito spent, most of their monastic life, trying to create an environment for where women could practice. It wasn't always ideal or always, maybe didn't turn out to be the best, but they tried. They tried to provide situations for women to be able to practice. And so that actually helped the process, though. It actually sort of, let people know that women are serious about practice and they actually can be monastics, whereas they probably before that, their people would have been more cut off or more, no, it just doesn't exist. So I look at it as it's really quite joyful, and the fact that, when I first was looking at ordaining, is the answer to that question was they don't exist, but now they do. Just in 15 years, the whole attitude has shifted. So hopefully, and I've heard Ajahn Amaro once, it was before I ordained, someone asked him, how he saw the bhikkhuni situation, what's it going to be like, and and he said something like, 50 years from now, Buddhism in America won't look anything like what we know it today. And it's like in 15 years, it shifted quite a bit. So that's a short answer. So it's just now 9 o'clock. Is that what time the program ends? Okay, well, thank you for coming. And is there any announcements that need to be made? Or?
One announcement, that there's still space in the workshop tomorrow, but I already said that. So thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.